There's a little disagreement over why some wildfires get so big and destructive. It's because there's fuel out there, trees, brush, and other items living and dead that feed the fire. There's disagreement over how to deal with it. Some people say thinning of smaller material. Others say log the big trees. There's a lot of ground in between. But there's now a more centralized repository of information about the fuel that's out there. The North American Wildland Fuel Database compiles huge amounts of data into a single database, complete with maps showing where fuels are, what they are, and how much of them there is. Researchers at the University of Washington and Michigan Tech gathered for the project with aid from the U.S. Forest Service. We have with us two of the lead authors from the University of Washington. Susan Pritchard is at the University of Washington School of Environmental and Forest Sciences. That's at UW Seattle. Susan, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Good to have you. Maureen Kennedy is with us as well, Assistant Professor in Quantitative Fire Ecology and Forest Management. That's at UW Tacoma. Maureen, welcome to you.
Hi, thank you. Good to be here.
Good to have you both. So, Susan, let's start with you. This looks like a massive project. How did you even begin?
We began because we've been trying to figure out ways to help a developing field of trying to improve our predictions of smoke. Many of us in the western United States have breathed in a lot of summer wildfire smoke, and we want to get to a point where our predictions of how much smoke is going to be delivered to communities and how hazardous is it, and also how long will it be, is better. We have a really great weather prediction system in our country, one of the best in the world, but our smoke prediction system is just in its infancy. As you mentioned, fuels are a big part of how much smoke is actually produced in a wildfire, and so we wanted to get to the point where we can inform better mapping of how much fuel is out there to burn in these wildfires and then inform the smoke models.
So, Maureen Kennedy, for you, how critically important is it for fire managers to know the fuel loads? I mean, how helpful is it for them to have some idea of what they're facing in that sense?
Yeah, so fuels are really, really important, like Susan said, for smoke itself. And in terms of the wildfire itself, something that we discuss is that the wildfire itself is actually driven by fuels. Absolutely are important in the wildfire, but so is weather, which is why, Susan, one of the reasons I think it's important to have that really good weather prediction, and by the long-term climate patterns. And so how much has the long-term, for example, in California, the long drought would have long-term drying of the fuels themselves. So all those things work together for how wildfires spread and behave. But in terms of the sort of larger scale health impact, smoke is really, really important. And again, it's like a conservation of mass. The more fuels on the ground, those get directly translated when they burn up into smoke in the atmosphere. And so the amount in particular and the composition of those fuels is really important for how much smoke actually gets released during the wildfire.
Maureen, how often do firefighters or fire managers anyway know what's out there in terms of amount of fuel and composition of it?
Yeah, that's really, really hard. And so one of the things that we do have, if you don't actually opportunistically measure the fuels before a wildfire event, that of course you can't really predict how it happens, then it's really difficult to know what fuels are exactly on the ground in any given place and time. And so we do have existing maps of fuels. Before we did this project, there are some resources with maps of fuels that tell us what might be on the ground in a given time and place based on some of our best information, satellite observations, vegetation, and expert opinion. But unless you actually measure those fuels directly, the actual amount that's being burned in the fire might be more or less than the value given on the map itself. And so one of the things that was really important to us was to understand how we can put ranges or bounds on that very vague more or less. And so what would be a lower plausible bound and an upper plausible bound for the fuels that the managers might actually encounter if they haven't had the opportunity or the resources to measure the fuels directly. But of course, the state of the art would be to have direct on the ground measurements.
So, Susan, I'm hearing that maps did exist before and databases existed before. You've essentially pulled them all into one big system now?
That's correct. One of the great tools that fire and fuel managers have is the land fire system. And basically what land fire does is pull together a lot of satellite-based imagery of vegetation and then predict how much fuel is on the ground. They have a wide variety of layers to do so. But each of those layers basically has a single prediction of how much fuel is for each satellite image pixel, so say a 30 meter by 30 meter pixel. We wanted to, as Maureen said, pull together field data where people have taken the trouble to actually go to a site and measure how much grass is there, how many shrubs, what's the biomass of the shrubs and grass, and then also fine wood and coarse wood, the tree litter such as pine needles, and then organic soils. So once those pine needles and wood decay, they become organic soil. So the database actually creates this accounting of those carefully measured fuels at each site so that we can do a little bit better than what Landfire has been able to do in the past. So for each point in the ground, we don't just have a single value that we can use. We know something about the range of variability out there and also what's most probable in terms of those fuels.
We're talking about the North American Wildland Fuel Database here on the Jefferson Exchange. It really provides a look at what wildfire fuels are potentially out there by a number of categories, a number of layers. We'll get into some of the more the weedy parts of the report, almost literally here. We're talking to Susan Pritchard and Maureen Kennedy from the University of Washington, Seattle, and Tacoma, respectively. You can join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. And feel free to look at these maps while we're talking about them. The address is fuels.mtri.org/map. fuels.mtri.org/map. So Maureen Kennedy, how difficult or not was it to get all of the individual data sets? I guess there's something like 271 sources with multiple records at each into this one big database.
Yeah, this was a massive, massive collaborative effort. Susan really spearheaded. She has a lot of good contacts out there to be able to even identify where these data sources are. And then we had a really excellent database manager, so Paige Eagle, and then Ann Andrew in particular, really contributed to cleaning the data. As you can imagine, going through all these tens of thousands of individual records was really, really quite an undertaking. And that was honestly the bulk of the work done here, was just the effort to put together all of these data observations and also to make sure that they're clean. And by clean, we mean that there weren't any mistakes in how the data were entered. For example, a misplaced decimal or an error in the units. And so the tremendous effort, massively collaborative, and it really compiled, like you said, this really massive database. But something else that was really surprising to us is when we put together this massive database that had, like I said, tens of thousands of records, when we started to sort of look at the maps of the data and in particular the kinds of vegetation types that were represented, there was actually a lot of holes in the database. I kind of call this the Swiss cheese effect, mm-hmm. that if you sort of scroll through the spreadsheet, you see a lot of empty cells because we're missing a lot of data in actually some really important wildfire vegetation types. And so one of the things that we're really excited about is that this database has the capacity to be what we call a living database, where if there might be some measurements of fuels that we weren't able to identify, people can go to the website, there's an email address, and they can send us that data that we can then add to the database and start filling in some of those gaps. And we're hoping really that this will spur additional resources to measure fuels directly to fill in some of those holes. So again, we can have really good estimates and really good understanding of the fuels that might be in different kinds of vegetation.
Were most of the data sets fairly consonant with one another, not measuring extraneous things that the other data sets didn't measure? Are they all basically on the same scales, the same things they are measuring?
There was some discrepancies in terms of the types of fuel layers that they measured. And so some sources were focusing on measuring what we call the fine fuels, sort mm-hmm. of the twigs and the leaves and the small branches. Other places might have concentrated more on those coarse fuels, like the larger branches or the larger downwoody debris that tend to burn a little bit more slowly. And that was also another part of sort of the Swiss cheese effect in the database, was that we had some vegetation types that had really good representation of some of the fuels, but not the others. So we had both low representation across an entire vegetation type, and then within a vegetation type, we didn't necessarily have a full accounting of all the different kinds of fuel layers. But I think, Susan, you can speak a little bit. There's some vegetation types where that's less important. Isn't that right, in terms of the fuels you might find?
Absolutely. So in different places, some fuels are going to be much more important than others. So, for instance, there's been a lot of focus on wildfires in northern forest types, such as boreal forests, that have cold soils for a lot of the year. And so they tend to accumulate a lot of forest litter, so again, tree needles and fine wood, that then slowly decompose. And so they have this big layer that we often call duff. It's organic soil. And that's a big consideration for those forest types, because if wildfires do occur, and they have been much more frequently in the past couple decades, we end up having long-duration fires that burn very slowly and inefficiently in those duff layers. And they also produce a lot of smoke that's very unhealthy to breathe. And so as we kind of tour through the very varied vegetation types throughout North America, where we are has a lot to do with what the fuels are on the ground and how important they are to smoke production.
Okay. I hadn't even thought about the fact that, yes, with a duff fire, you're going to have a slow and smoldery and probably pretty smoky kind of fire.
Exactly. Right.
Let us take a phone call. Anne in Eugene is on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Susan Pritchard and Maureen Kennedy from the University of Washington.
Thank you. Well, I'm worried that people working on different aspects of this problem are in their own little silos, and they really don't know what's going on outside their own silo. I heard something here on Jefferson Exchange about a month ago that I found fascinating, and that was the Wild Horse Fire Brigade, of using the wild horses that the BLM is always saying, we have too many wild horses, and putting them in areas where they would eat down the fuel load of the grasses and the brush, and that they would tend to stay where they're put. Anyway, I was wondering if you're familiar with that website and what your thoughts are about it.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Anne. Appreciate that. So Susan, I mean, Wild Horse Fire Brigade was an idea that somebody in Northern California had proposed as a way to reduce fire fuels. But obviously lots of ideas out there. I mean, as you work on a project like this, how aware are you of people on other working in other venues like that?
I really appreciate the listener's concern. These are wicked problems that we're having right now with wildfires and smoke. And so as scientists, a couple of things that we try to keep in mind are, one, we don't want to be siloed. We're very highly integrated with one another, and that's by design. But we're also trying to connect with communities and better understand what communities need in terms of even predictions of prescribed fire and better preparation for those smoke events where we're trying to actually reduce the fuel loads. Now, when it comes to the wild horse,
Wild Horse Fire Brigade is the term they originated.
I have not heard of that, but in Washington State, there's the Washington State Prescribed Fire Council. One of the members of that council are the Cattlemen's Association. There has been quite a bit of talk about how grazing in some cases can reduce the living fuel load, such as grasses and shrubs, and potentially be one of the solutions to reducing fire risk, or even addressing cheatgrass. So, yes, I think we're aware that grazing can play a role at times. One thing that I do caution people about is that cows and horses really don't like to eat dead wood.
Okay.
And after many decades of loss of fire in these ecosystems, much of our fire problem isn't in the grasses or the shrubs. It's actually in a lot of that accumulated dead wood and litter.
And we are talking to people who would know that here on the Jefferson
Right.
Exchange. Susan Pritchard and Maureen Kennedy are among the creators of the North American Wildlands Fuels database, which allows you to look at what the fuels are out there potentially for wildland fire. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Look at the maps yourself and peruse them at fuels.mtri.org/map, MTRI, Michigan Tech Research Institute, fuels.mtri.org/map. So Maureen, I've been looking pretty closely at our region, noticing how purple it is, indicating that there's a greater concentration of fuel loads. But then I actually broadened the map out a bit this morning to look at the rest of the country, and it seems like some of the greatest concentrations are in the Northwest, generally north of the San Francisco Bay Area.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of fuels up here in general, particularly in the Northwest. We're very, very productive in terms of forests. And, of course, on the west side in general of the northern or the Pacific Northwest, we have high productivity, a lot of fuels that, as just from your weather report, right, tends to be very, very wet. Mm-hmm. And so those historically actually have accumulated a lot of fuels just by that high productivity and a long time between fires, because it takes really a very, very extreme drought to make the fuels dry enough to be actually available to burn. And so on the west side of the Pacific Northwest, fires would be on what we call a long fire return interval. On the east side of the Pacific Northwest, if you consider the Cascade Crest up here, those fires, those locations historically were very, very dry. And before fire suppression, we would have a lot of wildfire occurring fairly often on the landscape. So we call that a short fire return interval, and that would tend to naturally reduce the fuels. And what we're having now is, due to, in part, fire suppression, those fuels have been able to accumulate in those landscapes, and that's causing a lot of what we're seeing with these really, really hazardous fires. And so a little bit of, on the west side, a natural accumulation that you would expect with a long fire return interval. On the east side, a little bit less of what we might say historically in terms of fuels that we're starting to see burn up, because the biomass is there, the fuels are there, and we know that those forests are really dry, and so those fuels tend to be also available to burn. And you put those two things together, and that's going to cause a really big fire that's going to cause a good amount of smoke.
So as we go up that scale and get into more purple on the map, for those of who are following along at home, you'll understand what I mean once you see these. And in fact, if you look at our web blurb, we show all the purple just in our immediate radio service region. Are we measuring just biomass, or is it biomass cross-referenced with some moisture indicator too?
This would just be biomass.
Just biomass, you're saying, Susan?
Correct. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes it's you have to look at these maps with a little bit of care, too, which is that some of the purple that you might be seeing would be trees. And wildfires don't necessarily burn up trees every time. So we can have what we call crown fires, where a fire will be burning the surface fuels such as grasses and shrubs, and then be able to carry into the crowns of trees and burn them. But some of the biomass that we're documenting in this website is not always going to be burned in these wildfires. So, for instance, if you have a lot of biomass in the trees, that might look like a big punch for a wildfire, but it might not actually burn up in that wildfire.
Okay, I noticed too, Maureen, when I toggle between layers, you know, trees and shrubs and stuff like that, and also change the loading statistic from, say, mean to standard deviation, I see some differences. What's happening, particularly on the math part of that?
Yeah, so this is actually a really important, we think, contribution here, is that, again, the mean value is similar to what you might get on that land fire tool that Susan described previously. Mm-hmm. So that's just sort of our point estimate, the thing that you might, what we call the expected value, the thing you might expect on the landscape. But the standard deviation describes that variability in that location. And so the idea is, for a given vegetation type, fuels themselves are really, really dynamic. I mean, I experienced that in my own backyard, where I've seen fuels accumulate and go away with the seasons, with different disturbances as branches fall from my Douglas firs in my backyard, for example. And so even though you might have an idea of what you expect for a given vegetation type, there's still going to be some variability. And so again, this idea of putting lower and upper bounds on that expected value, saying, well, here's what we might expect in this location, but really we think it might actually be between, say, X and Y. And so the standard deviation is one way of helping us to describe that. And if you also look, Susan, do you remember which tab it was for those distribution density? I can't remember. Shoot.
I don't have the database right in front of me, so
okay.
I have to look.
Yes, sorry, I should have prepared. But there's another tab that actually shows that basically puts together the mean and the standard deviation to get a look at what we call the density function or that probability function. And so, again, it shows which values are most probable, but also the extreme values that we have actually measured in those different vegetation types.
Now, go ahead, Susan.
Viewer.
What's that?
It's called the fuel bed viewer.
Fuel bed. All right, that's okay. That's what I thought we were looking at there. All right, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, I was just looking at that. So I also noticed, though, as I ran across the other tabs about, there's one tab there that says, I have data to contribute. So, Susan, your people are able to put some stuff potentially into this database?
Yes, we've had a lot of interest already in the North American Wildland Fuels Database. And Marty Alexander from Canada just contributed a large data set from his master's thesis way back in the 1980s. We're looking for other contributors. It would be exciting to get more from Canada and Mexico as well, so that we can have this database really truly be a living database. And as we become aware of more field-based observations, we can add them.
All right. This does seem like a massive job, though. I mean, so you're able to fill in the holes in Swiss cheese, you're saying, over time, potentially with some of these contributions.
Correct. And another thing that we would love to call out to the research community is that we're really missing a lot of the rangeland fields. So those would be shrublands and grassland fields. We have a lot of plots in forests, oftentimes because we need to know about their timber value. So there's the Forest Inventory and Analysis Program with the Forest Service, and that contributed a lot of plots within forested areas. But there's been less attention to shrublands and grasslands, and this database would be much stronger if we could find those data to contribute to it.
It's really fascinating and really draws in a map geek like me, but it probably will help a lot of people in managing wildfires as well. It's called the North American Wildland Fuels Database. Susan Pritchard at the University of Washington, Seattle. Maureen Kennedy at the University of Washington, Tacoma. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot.